I was very disappointed not to be in the famous photograph. Send us a postcard and we'll play your request next week. There was always a bad feeling when somebody took over somebody else's show.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. David Hamilton.
Well, I would say that I was part of the radio generation. I mean, after that, there was the television generation and now the computer generation. And I grew up on a very remote farm in Sussex where my only companions were cows. And so the radio was the window to my world.
That man again.
All these wonderful programs like ITMAR and Take It From Here, comedians who all had their little catchphrases. I won't take me coat off, I'm not stopping.
I think she used to work in the cinema. She charged me £1.09 to go upstairs.
Can I do you now, sir? You know, all those things.
Can I do you now, sir?
And the radio commentaries of football commentaries of people like Raymond Glendenning.
Who has what?
The radio was my window to the world, and it brought the world into our remote farmhouse. I used to listen to Radio Luxembourg when I was a boy because that was the only station that played rock and roll, and I was part of the rock and roll generation. And although the signal faded all the time and you were twiddling the knob to get the best reception, I mean, amazing when you think about it now, one of my first heroes was Pete Murray. And I used to listen to Pete on Radio Luxembourg. He was very funny, very witty, very entertaining. And I saw a photograph of him in a magazine called Fab 208. And he was horse riding in the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg. And I thought, what a fabulous job. He goes horse riding and answering his fan mail by day, and he plays records at night. I'd like to do something like that.
Which reminds me, the wind is whistling through this studio door today. I think Jack Jackson's been eating beans again. I can always tell.
And I told one or two of my colleagues at school. I went to a grammar school in Surrey. And they said, ah, you, what, with your South London accent, you'd never get on the radio like that, because everybody in those days spoke, talk proper, you know, they spoke very nicely. So I thought, oh dear, well, so I went up to London and I hired a Grundig tape recorder. It was a huge thing and I lugged it home. It had spools, of course, and I read things from the newspaper into it, and I gradually got rid of the rough edges of my voice so that in the end I'd play it back and I thought, well, that sounds a bit better. But it's funny, isn't it? Because nowadays, accents are in. And, I mean, even, you know, continuity announcers now on television. Well, yeah, coming up next, it's, you know. I think the reason behind standard English in the early days, and particularly when you look at the World Service, was that actually everybody could understand it.
This is the BBC World Service.
That was the point. It didn't matter where you were, whether you were in Scotland, Ireland, Wales, or indeed abroad. If you had a standard English voice, I think this was the thinking, everybody could understand what you were saying. But my first job I got, I managed to get, was as a scriptwriter at ATV. I was really loving my job when, unfortunately, a brown envelope arrived on the mat, and I was called up for national service in the RAF. And I thought, oh, God, what a drag. I mean, this, I've interrupted this lovely career that I'd got, you know, a sort of burgeoning career. Anyway, I was at RAF Withall, which was near Birmingham, and my squadron were posted to Digby in Lincolnshire. And I knew the only hope for me was to get to Germany, to Cologne, which was the home of what was then British Forces Network, now BFBS, and the German end of Two Way Family Favourites, which is the big record show of the time.
Time in Britain is 12 noon. In Germany, it's 1 p.m., but at home and away, once again, it's time for Two-Way Family Favourites.
So I went to see the careers officer. That, by the way, I'd already told them when I got called up, they said to me, what do you want to do? I said, well, the only thing to stop this being a complete waste of time is for me to work in radio. So they made me a wireless operator, listening to Morse code. I think this was their idea of a joke. Anyway, I went to see this guy, and for some miraculous reason, I almost pleaded with him. I said, look, I've really got to get to Germany, otherwise it's going to be a complete waste of time. Anyway, I don't know how I did it. I mean, in Air Force terms or Forces terms, it was almost impossible. But the rest of the squadron went to Lincolnshire, and I went to Butzweilerhof, which was near Cologne. So having, you know, miraculously got there, I went to see the station director, And I said, look, I'm a scriptwriter. Can you use me? He said, well, we don't actually have scriptwriters. He said, but as it happens, we do need somebody to read the football results. So I was quite a football fan. I thought, well, that'll do for me. So that was the first broadcast I did. It was in Germany. It was 1959. And I read the football results. So after a few weeks of this, I went to see the station director and I said to him, I said, all this music you're playing, Bing Crosby and Peggy Lee, I said, it's great for the officers, but the troops want rock and roll.
When I woke up this morning,
he said, how do you know? I said, because I am a troop. So he didn't quite know, I think, what rock and roll was. So he said to me, well, who do you mean then? So I said, well, Little Richard, Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis Presley, who was there in Germany at the same time with the US Army. So he said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I'll give you a one-hour show on Sunday afternoon. We'll see how it goes. Of course, the troops absolutely loved it. And because he was so worried about transmitting this heathen music to the troops, he followed it with a talk by the Padre, so the Padre could come on and cleanse their sins. I had a year there which I absolutely loved. I mean, I was, 19? This wonderful music that changed the world, you know. Until then, it had been, how much is that doggy in the window? And feet up, pat him on the popo.
Feet up, pat him on the popo.
And then all of a sudden, you know, we've got this music that has energy, it has zest, makes you want to get up and dance. And I used to dance around the studio to it. It was in those days, by the way, 1959, we were self-opping, which was way ahead of, because it was all German equipment. I think it was Telefunken, and it was the best equipment. You know, studios were wonderful. So I'd put on Bill Haley and the Comets or whatever, rock around the clock, and I'd be rocking around the studio. I get back to the mic, I was out of breath. Then my national service finished, I came home. It was very, very difficult to get into radio. BBC didn't play rock and roll. The DJs and DJs was hardly even really a job description. They were presenters, and a lot of them were ex-band leaders, people like Jack Payne and Jack Jackson. Of course, he was very good, and he had his, oh, it's Sunday.
So until next time we meet, this is Jack Jackson and saying so long for now.
So it was very, very difficult, and I went back to my scriptwriting job, and one day a vacancy came up for a television announcer in Manchester. In those days, announcers appeared in Vision in between the programmes. So it was ABC. I went along to their studios at Teddington, and the head of presentation said to me, I want you to ad-lib to camera for 1 minute about Sunday night's programmes, and here's the TV times. Well, of course, I knew all the programmes because I'd been writing about them, and I knew all the phraseology. So, and I also knew the timing because I knew how long a minute was because I had to write one-minute scripts. So I sat there to camera, and rolled off, without looking at the TV times, rolled off all the Sunday night at the London Palladium, the Avengers, Armchair Theatre, wonderful schedule. And I went through it all, and he looked at me and he said, well, you've got the job. So I went to one of the announcers who was in Manchester. His mother was ill back in South Africa, so he went home for 3 months to see his mother. So I was standing in just for 3 months, and then he came back. And then I went to Tyne Tees in Newcastle, and at Tyne Tees, I was there in 1961, I learnt everything about television. I learnt announcing, where you're no auto cue, you know, you're there to camera, you've got 2 minutes to fill, you know, you fill it, and you come out bang on time for Coronation Street or whatever the programme was. I did local news reading, so that's another technique, and I did programme hosting as well. I mean, this was all part of your contract. And I think it was something like £1,500 a year. And but what a great way to learn television. So later on, when opportunities came along to do national programmes, it's not like now when people are pitchforked in, you know, they're on Big Brother and the next minute they're celebrities and they're doing everything. In those days, you had to learn your craft. And there was a lot of discipline that you learnt that was very, very good for you.
Hello again. Just a reminder that tomorrow is liftoff day for Apollo 11, and our coverage and our programme Man on the Moon begins at 2:10 tomorrow afternoon. But now we move along with performer and composer and Anthony Hopkins.
I remember once going to referee a football match in one of the mining villages, And after the match, they said, come on, lad, you know, we'll have a pint of brown ale, you know, and a brown ale. And I got back to the studios and I had to read the news. And my head was spinning round. I thought, oh, God, I feel drunk. So I put my head under the tap. And then I went on the air and I had to dig my nails into my hands to, you know, get my act together, so to get through it. And the lesson I learnt was never drink before you work. And from that day onwards, I never, ever drink before I work. Even doing stage shows, I would never have a drink. I enjoy a drink afterwards. But for me, that became early on a golden rule. And there were so many things you learned in those early days. I remember somebody saying to me, went to see a show somewhere, and they said, when another pro is on, you don't talk. Because how would you feel if you were on and people in the audience were, you know, because there were lots of clubs in those days and people sat at tables and sometimes they talked. And they said, when you're a pro, you know, you don't talk, you pay attention, because put yourself in the position of... So it's so many good things that you learnt which have stayed with me all the time. I went back to ABC and in 1967... there was a series called Doddy's Music Box on ITV Saturday nights. That was Ken Dodd, and they were looking for... Ken had been working with a man called David Marlowe at the BBC, but he was under contract to the BBC. So they were looking for a new straight man, as it were. And he said, what about that chap who does the announcing and reads the news? What about him? So he didn't know how tall I was, you know. So we turned up for the first day of rehearsals, and in the studio were makeup artists and the props boys and cameramen. And he called me Diddy David, and everybody chuckled. So in fairness to him, he took me to one side afterwards and he said, do you mind me calling you that? He said, because if you mind, I won't do it anymore. He said, but if you don't mind, I think it'll stick. So I said, well, I don't mind. I've been stuck with it now for about 45 years.
Good morning, everyone. This is the BBC night programme on wavelengths of 1,500 and 261 metres.
Well, my first radio broadcast back home was in December 1962, and it was a programme called The Beat Show, which was from the Playhouse Theatre in Manchester. And at that particular time, the BBC light programme had some of these hybrid programmes where you had a house band, in this case the Northern Dance Orchestra, and pop groups of the day. And I remember the phrase that I opened it with, it sounds so corny today, but it was supposed to be hip at the time. I would say I had a little lip mic on the stage at the Playhouse Theatre. It was recorded on Monday nights, went out Thursday lunchtime. It's The Beat Show with Bernard Herrmann and the NDO, the band with the beat that's reet. And I thought at the time, this is really hip, you know, really. But what happened was the band would play cover versions of Herb Alpert hits, and the audience would be eating their sweets and their popcorn and everything, the girls in the audience. And then on would come the Searchers or the Swinging Blue Jeans or Dave D. Dozy, Beaky Mick and Titch or Wayne Fontana or the Mindbenders, and they'd go crazy. So it wasn't really satisfactory. I mean, it was a compromise, like so many things were at the Beeb in those days.
On the Harbour, Radio London, World News.
Dateline Thursday, September the 2nd, the Speaker. The Harry Hilton Foster, Speaker of the House of Commons, collapsed and died.
But it was the time that the Pirates had come along and completely revolutionised radio, and we were still in this archaic method of part discs and part tapes recorded at BBC studios, because it was the Musicians Union who insisted that, you know, they had this big campaign, keep music live. So not only was it BBC house orchestras, but also groups would go into studios and record a cover version of their song, which could never ever be as good as the record. Well, my first programme from London, I think, was 1965, and that was a programme called Swing Into Summer. And it was a repertory of people who would do a week each, so they probably had about 13 people. They were trying them out, I think. We didn't know it at the time, probably for what was ahead, you know. The staffing was quite interesting. We had... The programmes were done from the basement of Broadcasting House, and on the other side of the glass would be a producer, a producer's secretary, complete with stopwatch, you know, timing everything, there would be a Grams operator, a disc operator, and a studio manager, at least. So it'd be at least five people, a job that's done by one person today. You had to write a script. So you'd get the script a few days in advance and you'd write it all. And then in the morning, although it was an afternoon show, you would go down to the studio and you would do tops and tails. So you would hear the dying seconds of the previous record. Then you'd hear the opening of the next one, so you could do your voiceover, and your script would just have to fit nicely up until the vocal. If you crashed the vocal, that was one of the biggest sins in the world, and you would know, oh my God, I won't be invited back, that's it. I had one producer who was particularly picky, and he said to me, I notice you use the expression right now rather a lot. So I went, oh really, do I? So he said, yes, he said... And I mean, everybody would say in those days, you stand right now, right now. So he said, yes. He said, are there other ways we could say it? He said, you could say just now, couldn't you? Or you could say now. He said, that's a nice word, isn't it? Now. It's very English, isn't it? It's a nice word. So I said to him, you don't like right now. He said, no, I don't like right now. So I went through my script. This is over lunch. I crossed out every right now I could find. So we're now doing the programme live, and I find myself on a voiceover saying, I've missed one, saying, and right now I thought, oh my God, that's it. I'm finished. I'll never work again. I've said right now. Oh dear. You look back at it now and you think, crazy. But we wanted to please, you know, or we had lunch in the BBC Club. So you had tops and tails in the morning, lunch in the BBC Club, which is where the conversation happened. Then you go off to the loo and think about it. Oh, I better not say right now.
This is the BBC Light Programme. Here is the news.
Well, there was tremendous overstaffing, and I would work with various different producers, and then they would say to me, oh, I won't be here next time. And I'd say, you won't be here next time? No, I'm off on a sabbatical. And I didn't really know. I'd never heard the word before. I didn't know what a sabbatical was. I had to look it up. But I realized what actually happened, I discovered later, was that if they'd been working there for a certain number of years, they were given a six-month sabbatical. So they just went off and had fun. I had a Radio 2 program in later times where I had something like four producers. I had one who did the records, one who did the tapes, at the Maida Vale studios where they recorded, one who did speech content, and then an executive producer who was also the executive producer of several programmes, who would decide where outside broadcasts would be done from. You know, I think we'll go to Stoke-on-Trent and visit the Potteries, you know. Oh, yeah, so who should we send? I tell you a brilliant idea that I came up with when I was at Radio 1. They sent me to Scotland for Civic Week at Hamilton. I went to Hamilton. So I saw the town that my name came from. I was a bit disappointed. I found it was a little mining village just outside Glasgow. And I thought, I think the museum was the most exciting part of place of it. But it was funny.
Well, there we end broadcasting in the Light Programme. Not just for today, but as it seems, forever.
Well, I almost buried the Light Programme because on the last day, I did the final Housewives Choice. And I did the final Music Through Midnight, which I think was... I was doing that every Friday, and I think that was virtually I think it was a Friday. It was virtually the last programme. So I had two programmes on the last day of the Light programme. And having been working for them for quite a long time, I have to say I was very disappointed not to be in the famous photograph that appeared again and again of the original Radio 1 lineup on the steps of All Souls Church outside the BBC. There were one or two hangovers from the Light programme. There was Jimmy Young and Pete Murray, but largely it was pirates. And of course, I mean, again, I didn't realise at the time that I think the government had said, look, we've outlawed, this is very unpopular, we've outlawed these pirate radio stations. And if we use some of their broadcasters, or a lot of their broadcasters, this will be, you know, this will appease the public a bit. So I think that's probably what happened. I think one of them only lasted one show, mentioning no names. Radio 2 gave me a show, which was The Golden Sons of Frank Chaxfield. And it went out, I think, sometime during the evening. And Frank was a lovely guy, and it was beautiful music. But it was, of course, very old-fashioned. So here was I at 29 playing, saying, and this is for Alice on your 90th birthday. Here are Frank and the boys, and Alice Blue Gown or whatever it was. So, yeah, and you could see all the time, all the publicity. Radio 1 was getting all the excitement. And Radio 2 was very much really Radio 2 at the time. So, yeah, that was very disappointing.
At 10 o'clock, it's Keith Skews with Saturday Club on Radio 1, followed by the fabulous Impro Roscoe at 12 noon. And on Radio 2, it's the Max Jaffa Show up to midday with Sandy McPherson at the organ and the music light and tuneful, followed by some lovely waltzes and marches up to 1 p.m.
Well, I started off doing Family Choice, which took over from Junior Choice. I think that was actually a Radio 2 production, but it was heard on Radio, it could have been Radio 1, but it was heard on both networks, as were one or two programmes in the early days. And then I did some Radio 1 clubs and Pop In, that was another show. Then I started standing in for people on Radio 1 and Radio 2, Jimmy Young, Terry Wogan and so on. And in 1973, Radio 1 offered me my own daily show. And along with Tony Blackburn, I was the first person to have a three-hour daily show. Tony had 3 hours in the morning, I had 3 hours in the afternoon, and Noel Edmonds was on breakfast, Johnny Walker on lunchtime. It was a fabulous lineup to be part of. The only problem that we had, and I can say it now, is the old needle time problem. And most of the needle time was used up before I came on at 2 o'clock. And I think a third of my programme was non-needle time. In other words, it was tapes that were recorded in BBC studios, either by groups. If they were done by groups or bands and they didn't sound like the real thing, we could play the record because nobody would know, and the point was that they'd been paid, you know, for going in and doing the session. If it sounded pretty good and almost like the record, then we would play the tape. But one of the most difficult things we had a lovely idea, which was everything stops for tea at 3 o'clock, and we had the jingle, which is still around.
If you're sliding all alone or relaxing, are you working in a noisy factory?
Just great idea, you know, everything stops for tea. Unfortunately, it was followed by something like a 5-minute segue of music by the Johnny Arthey Band and Singers. And with due respect to them, good though they were, it wasn't records. And, of course, 1973 was the year that commercial radio opened, with LBC in London and Capital in London, and then gradually stations opened up all over the country. And, of course, they programmed against it. And so you would have, for example, on Capital at 3 o'clock, it would be Roger Scott and his 3 o'clock thrill, who would come in with three stonking great records, you know, maybe rock and roll records, while we've got the Johnny Arthey Singers.
Well, it's best part of Break It Up is getting rid of his dirty socks, and then you make up again. 4:24, it's Man McCoy.
But we made the best of it, and we kept our heads above water. It did very well. And in 1975, the BBC had one of its periodical economy cuts, and cut the corresponding programme on Radio 2, which meant for the next 2.5 years, I think it was, the programme went out on Radio 1 and 2, which gave it the biggest audience of the day because it was on two networks in the afternoon. Radio 2 then went from, I think you could hear it in Ireland, across to Paris. It had the most enormous signal. And we had a very good audience. It led to me doing Top of the Pops, Seaside Special, programmes like that.
It's the David Hamilton Show, Monday to Friday, 2 to 5 on Switched On, Radio 1.
I was just in a whirl of work and loving it. I mean, I would be one night in Aberdeen, the next night in Plymouth. I'd be travelling all over the country. I'd be doing a 5-day radio show. And, of course, at that age, I had enormous energy, so that really helped. It just went by like that.
We have the most amazing scenes going on here this afternoon, as you can no doubt hear, partly going on behind us since the rollers have been here. We have a little river surrounding, two various parts of the track here, and the girls are actually swimming across the river to try and get at their idols.
There were some features that were not my idea, I have to say, and I look back now, and I think maybe they were wrong for the time. There was one thing which was called Beauty Tips for Women. and we had a man, i.e. me, telling women how to keep young and beautiful. And we played the jingle. Now imagine this today. Keep young and beautiful. It's your duty to be beautiful. Keep young and beautiful if you want to be loved. I mean, the women's libbers who were, that movement was kind of starting at that time. It must have alienated an awful lot of people. And to compound the felony, we actually brought out a book of David Hamilton's beauty tips for women with a picture of me on the cover, and inside were all the tips that they'd sent in, and we sold them back to them. I mean, you know, I didn't think of the implications at the time. I just went along with it. But funnily enough, you know, at that time everybody accepted it, and I didn't get there was no backlash of, you know, how dare you as a man tell us that we should be beautiful and if we want to be loved. That wasn't really happening at that time.
Radio 1, it's the show with that. Ooh!
What I do remember about the 70s was it was just a great, fun time. It was compared with today and all the modern technology of today. You see, you didn't have the social media, and so what I remember when I was doing my shows at Radio 1 or Radio 2, on both channels in the afternoon, was that people would write in for a request. And so you'd send, mainly it was postcards, send us a postcard and we'll play your request next week. I mean, people don't wait 5 minutes now, do they? But that was the patience and the tolerance that we all had in those days, that we'd send in our card hoping that a week later it might be played.
And now for Radio 1 and 2 listeners, it's over to the David Hamilton Show.
Thank you, Len. Good afternoon.
Well, Tony Blackburn and I were good pals. I mean, we decided when we'd known each other before. I think he was pleased that I'd got my own daily show. So we decided we're going to be rude about each other on the air. So he would slag me off in the morning and I'd slag him off in the afternoon. In fact, he did one entire edition of Top of the Pops wearing a T-shirt saying, "I hate David Hamilton." And then I came on later in a T-shirt, made a little guest appearance and said, "And I hate Tony Blackburn." But it was just a gimmick, really. You know, it was like Hope and Crosby. You know, there was a lot of value to be had out of insult humour. Tony, of course, initially didn't get on with Noel Edmonds at all, and there was the famous Frosty handover, which is in existence somewhere, I think. But since in later times they made that up. There were always enmities between different people. There was always bad feeling when somebody took over somebody else's show. But it wasn't necessarily their fault because, you know, everybody wanted to work, and to get a show, somebody had to go for you to come in, as it were. I think there were suspicions that one or two people were backstabbers, that there were one or two people around who perhaps would stab you in the back. But generally, I think, you know, they were a good bunch of blokes. We had a good lot of laughs. I've got a lovely picture at home of 12 DJs at Radio 1 in the 70s, and I put it in a book. I did a book about Fulham Football Club, who I've been associated with for many years, and I put this picture in the book because there were 12 of us and everyone was a household name. There was Tony Blackburn, Noel Edmonds, John Peel, Terry Wogan, Alan Freeman and Nightingale, and so you go on, you know. And Savile, unfortunately, was also in the picture. And then when the book came out, of course, I really wanted, it was across two pages, I wanted to stick the two pages together because, you know, I was obviously so disgusted about Jimmy Savile. A lot of people say to me, "How much did you know about Savile?" Well, I have to make this clear. He was a recluse. He didn't mix with the other DJs at all. He was not a team player. He thought he was better than all of us. And I suppose in a way he was. I mean, he was the biggest star, really, in the galaxy. So I didn't ever see him with young girls, and there wasn't anything I could ever say. If I had gone to Derek Chinnery and said, "I believe that Jimmy Savile is a paedophile," he probably would have sacked me on the spot and said, "How dare you come in here, you know, with accusations like that." And also, I do believe you can't make accusations based on rumours. I heard stories, but I didn't never see him, so there's nothing I could say about it. But I do remember that when he died, based on the rumours that I had heard, I said to my wife, I think a few people may come out of the woodwork now. And of course, sure enough, that did happen. And when you look at the pictures of him now, because a lot of them were when he was very old, you see how sleazy he looked. And, you know, it seems to be there, doesn't it, right in front of your eyes. But what upsets me most about it is that he has spoilt that era, because there's been a big knock-on effect from that. What to me was an innocent, pretty innocent, fun era has been totally soiled, really, by Jimmy Savile.
Hello, good evening. Welcome once again to Top of the Pops.
As far as I was concerned, when I did Top of the Pops, I never had any guests in my dressing room. In fact, we used to record Top of the Pops on Wednesday night, and it went out on Thursday night. And afterwards, I used to do a pub in the Old Kent Road called the Dun Cow. And it was quite funny because I don't think I ever earned £100 doing Top of the Pops with about 15 million viewers. But a pub in the Old Kent Road, I got about £300 for working to 200 people. So I used to do the show and then race off to the pub where I did every Wednesday night, so I didn't hang around. But no, I think that is it's absolutely tarnished what was a great time, and it's a shame.
Well, a little bit later on in the year, the BBC, which is now flushed with pride and a little bit of money, will be splitting the networks, which means that we'll be getting a different programme in the afternoon on Radio 1 from the programme on Radio 2. Now, whether or not this particular show you'll be able to hear on Radio 1 or Radio 2, you will have to wait for that to be announced.
And everything was going very well until one day Derek Chinnery, who was the controller of Radio 1, said to me, we've got the money back now and we can restore a separate programme on Radio 2, and you've done such a good job of it that you'll be going to Radio 2. So at the time, I didn't want to be at Radio 2 because Radio 2 was not the station it is today. And I was very disappointed. I was doing lots of gigs, discos around the country, and I thought, well, this is all dependent on me doing Top of the Pops and Radio 1. But anyway, I made the move, and I stayed there about twice as long as I'd been at Radio 1 in the end.
You're in tune with Radio 2 on 1500 metres and VHF.
The best management I ever had at the BBC was a man called Jeff Owen, who was the controller of Radio 2. I never heard from him. I didn't hear from him from one month to another. And I went to his retirement party. I mean, every artist needs a little bit of a, hey, good show today. I like the way you said so-and-so. I was getting plenty of feedback from listeners, so that was okay. But I had no feedback at all from management. So when he retired, I said to him, Jeff, you know, I'm sorry you're going, but, you know, it was nice almost knowing you sort of thing, but in a nice way. And I said, you know, I never really heard from you. He said, I put professionals in place knowing that they would do a professional job. He said, if you'd done anything wrong, you would have heard from me all right. And I thought, that is good management. That's under management. And the next best boss I worked for after that was Ron Coles. And Ron was much the same. Ron, you didn't have any picky criticism. You had encouragement, but you knew you were working for a fair man and a decent man. And I respected that.
You make a few bob out of it, don't you? I mean, I heard
I
you...
Beg your pardon.
Don't you let out your back garden for car parking or something?
You're right about that. How did you know about that? Who told you that?
You have to supplement your wages somehow, don't you?
Supplement what wages?
David Hamilton!
Now, you're a professional. I'm still an amateur. You've got to remember that.
Well, good luck with the car parking.
I like
anyway,
this. What's this? What's this?
This is David Soul.
Oh, yes.
We asked him the other day, actually, how he felt about all this sport, you know, the tennis and all the horse racing we have this afternoon, and he said...
Oh.
It brings a cold shiver inside.
When I went to Radio 2, Radio 1 amazingly put Tony Blackman on at the same time of the afternoon. So the two of us who've been, you know, pals and all that, were now on at the same time. It was crazy. And my producer at Radio 1 became Tony's producer. And I remember one day on Radio 2 I was playing ABBA. And he came into the studio almost screaming. He said to me, "You're playing our music." So I said, "Pardon?" He said, "You're playing our music." So I said, "Well, I didn't know that ABBA were under exclusive contract to Radio 1. Anyway, he went to Derek Chinnery, who complained to Jeff Owen. And in fairness to Jeff Owen, he stood his ground and he said, "You worry about your network and I'll worry about mine." And we carried on playing ABBA. And we had a programme that continued to be sort of really Radio 1.5. We were playing T-Rex and stuff like that, all the kind of music that I had championed before. And so it had a credibility to it. I think we even kept the Hamilton Hotshots and the jingle. And I carried on. I was still doing the discos. I thought they'd all finished when I left Radio 1, but I was still chasing around the country. And the only thing that finished was Top of the Pops, because that went with being a Radio 1 DJ. But everything went well for a long time during Jeff Owen's time there, and it was a very happy time. I had some great producers who absolutely stood by me and said, "No, we're going to play this music, and any complaints, we'll ride it through." And we kept a lot of listeners, and we got a very, very good audience. And then Tony went off and did Junior Choice, I think, and other things, and I carried on for some time. Everything was fine until Francis Lyon came along. And Francis Lyon, who was a BBC secretary who had worked her way up through the ranks, brought out this edict that we were going to have more whistling and Wurlitzers, and we would have panpipes. And so I thought, well, anyway, I had dinner with her at the hotel next door to, and she said, "Look, we're prepared to offer you another contract, but you will have to play the music that we want to play." So I said, "Well, what is that?" So she said, "Well, you know, if it's Max Bygraves, or if it's Vera Lynn, or if it's Foster and Allen, you know." And I've been playing T-Rex, and this was a very difficult gear change. And I had a lot of letters from listeners saying, "Well, we love you, but the program's, you know, your music's gone really odd, you know." So I said to her, "Well, you brought out this nostalgia package, but there's no mention of Motown." So I got the impression she didn't know what I was talking about. And I thought, well, Motown is really the biggest single. If you're going to have a nostalgia package, because that music, particularly at that time, had stood the test of time so well and was almost timeless, you know, this wonderful catalogue. And here we have a nostalgia package with no Motown. And I thought, I can't do this.
That's Marty Webb, and No One Will Ever Know You. That's it. The last David Hamilton music show on Radio 2. Before I go, one or two people I'd like to say thank you to. Thank you to Paulie Walters, my producer.
Well, I felt very lump in throat. A very old friend of mine who gave me my scriptwriting job at ATV came up and joined my wife and myself for dinner afterwards, after the show. And but I know this sounds hard to believe. I did it on a principle. And the principle was that, you know, it wasn't, I didn't feel it was the right thing. And I didn't feel that Radio 2 was going the right way. And the Radio 2 of today is exactly how I thought it should have been then. And what it's become now is, you know, I felt this was wrong and I just couldn't be part of it. So I know a lot of people thought that I got sacked, and it seemed a crazy thing to do, but I jumped ship. And I joined a station called Radio 210 in Reading with an agreement that they would produce a show that we would network. And we networked it to about a dozen stations. And then later, when I moved to Capital Gold, we got it up to about 20 stations. So I was back in other parts of the country. I have to say that when I did my first outside broadcast, my first show for Radio 210, it was quite an odd time. It was in a shopping precinct in Basingstoke on New Year's Day. So it was about 10 o'clock in the morning on New Year's Day, when no one is at their best. No one at their best.
Yes, David Hamilton here. Welcome to a new year, a new radio service from Radio 210. We are live, at least I think we're live, at Owen Owen in Basingstoke.
It was the first, I think it was the first outside broadcast they had done. And it also, they just acquired a transmitter at Basingstoke and Andover, and they had split commercials. And nobody worked with these split commercials before, and the timings were out. One lot were longer than the others and everything. You get bits of dead air. And I have to say that when I got into my car and I hammered home up the M4 motorway, that was the moment I did think, what have I done? You know, what have I done? But Mark Simpson, who I saw the other day, and he asked me to take part in an obituary programme for Ed Stewart, told me that, I can't remember what he said the reach was that we had at 210, but it was something like, you'd know more about these figures than I do, 45 something. It was something that was, and Mark said, do you remember? I didn't remember it, but Mark would know the exact figures. And he said to me, the reach was something that nowadays people would only dream of. So I was still doing radio, it was just in a smaller pond.
Right, we're into your request hour. It's 071-4848-222 if there's a little message that we can do.
I had 6 years at Capital Gold, and then the team broke up, and Jeff Mullen, who had been one of my producers at Radio 2, said to me, why don't you come and do something for Melody? Yeah, that was interesting.
We had a song from Dean Martin, Angel Baby, and a Beatles tune from the Royal Philharmonic under the baton of David Arnold, Can't Buy Me Love.
It was Lord Hanson's station. Lord Hanson had heard beautiful music stations in America and said, I want to have my own station. So it was, you know, it was independently owned. And you didn't have to say a lot. It was mainly instrumental music. Then gradually Jeff Mullen, he said to Lord Hanson, look, you know, to get a bigger audience, we need to put a few vocals in. So then some vocals came in. But the other thing you did was you had to read the news. And, of course, I'd done that early in my career at Tyne Tees Television and ABC and other stations, so I had read news before. And so on the hour, you would read the news, and then mainly it was liner cards. And, I mean, the presentation to do was very boring. And it just amazed me, the number of people who told me how much they loved it. And I said, and actually, there was a sign, I remember this, there was a sign in the studio, and it said, Melody Radio, radio without speakers, or something like that. And I thought, well, that's me. I'm a non-speaker. They used to have ads on the side of buses, no disc jockeys, as though this was something wonderful we should all be celebrating. Music with no disc jockeys. And I've been earning my living as a disc jockey all these years. But I remember Lord Hanson, he was wonderful. He rang me one day, and he rang up and said, good morning, David, it's James here. I said, James? He said, James Hanson. Oh, I said, oh, good morning, sir. So he said, have you mentioned Lord White in the news? So I said, no, I don't think Lord White had died. No, I don't think we have. He said, have a word with the newsreader, would you, and make sure that, he's a very good friend of mine, make sure that she mentions it. So I went to the newsreader, who was a rather militant person. I said, I'm newswriter. She said, no, I'm not putting that in, that's not a... I said, I'm not going to do that. I said, I think it would be a good career move. I said, the man who pays the piper calls the tune. So in the end it went in. And about 10 minutes later, David James here, thanks for that. That was really good. Anyway, in the end, he sold it. It was probably the last great radio sale. And if my information is correct, in the previous year, it had made about £500,000. And he sold it for £25 million. You don't do that in radio these days. Wonderful. It was not the most exciting station I ever worked for, but lovely, lovely people. Jeff and I would always go and have breakfast after the show, and Lord Hanson was wonderful. Sheila Porritt, who was the managing director, she was lovely. Some few other people who worked there, but just lovely people to work with. There was a guy who was on there who was another presenter, and it was, can you imagine this on a very, very straight radio station? And this chap was gay. So anyway, he played Bryan Adams, Have You Ever Really Loved a Woman? He said, oh, he said, let me think about that. He said, yes, I was very fond of my mother. on this radio station, where I thought it was because of the normal delivery of the station. It was so funny. So there were good times.
To really love a woman, understand her.
Well, I tell you what happened there. Saga which was run by Ron Coase, who I mentioned earlier. It started off with Primetime Radio, which is one of the very early digital stations, which actually later got the award for Digital Station of the Year, which is great. Ron Coase, who put it all together, a lot of it was voice-tracked, but I did a three-hour live show every morning. I think it was 10 to 1 or something like that. And then came the great news that Saga had got an FM station in Birmingham. So Ron came into the studio one day and he said, would you like to do something in Birmingham? So I said, oh, yeah. And I thought, well, perhaps I could do a rock and roll show once a week or something like that. So he said, what about the breakfast show? So I said, well, I don't want to give this up. He said, well, you could do both, couldn't you? So I said, well, we put you up in a nice hotel in Birmingham. He said, you could do 6 to 9 breakfast at Birmingham. He said, go and have your breakfast in the hotel and then do 10 to 1 on prime time and record a few other programs in the afternoon. So I said, oh, well, let me have a think about it. So I said, let me have a word with Mrs. H and we'll think about it. So I did, and she said, I know you. She said, if you don't do it and somebody else does it and a great success, she said, I'll never hear the end of it. She said, you better, I think she's trying to get rid of me. She said, you better do it. So next day, Ron came in again, and I said, Ron, look, I've never ducked a challenge. I'll do it. So he said, well, that's great.
Hello, this is David Hamilton, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to a brand new station for the West Midlands, Saga 105.7 FM. We'll be playing melodic popular records from the 40s to the present day, and if that's your kind of music, then I'm sure this will be the station for you.
So I went up to Birmingham and did 3 hours breakfast live, 3 hours prime time live, recorded for about another hour, maybe hour and a half. So I was actually doing about 8 hours a day. I have to say, you know, he rewarded me very well, looked after me very well. And again, you know, lovely, lovely team. It was very hard work. And then after they extended my contract for about 3 months because they were getting Les Ross. Les Ross came in. So I was quite disappointed when it came to an end. So Ron said, don't worry, we've got other plans for you. I said, other plans? He said, yes, we've got a station in Nottingham now, and I want you to go and be part of the launch at Nottingham. So off I go to Nottingham. This time I did an afternoon show. So I did the primetime show in the morning, an afternoon show. And now the Saga bandwagon is rolling. They get a station in Glasgow. So I looked at him and I said, Glasgow? And he went, yes. And it was all set that I would go and do the same thing in Glasgow, when the shock news came through that Roger De Haan, who had owned Saga, which had been a family business, was selling up. And it turned out in the end that the people who acquired Saga were not interested in the radio division, and the whole thing was sold off. But it was a great time. And I must say that Ron was the best boss I ever worked for, without doubt.
Hi, I'm David Hamilton. Please join me every day at 10 a.m. on the wireless from Age UK. We've got a terrific show for you, and if you live in Yorkshire or in London, you can hear us on DAB.
I'll be honest with you, I record 14 four-hour shows in a day. The joys of voice tracking. I go into the studio, which is the old Classic FM studios in Camden Lock, and I start recording at about 11 and I finish at about 5, and I never stop talking really in the whole time. So my wife says, your life like that at home? And I said, yeah, but you don't pay me. And she said, but you should pay me for listening. But it is a long session. Voice tracking I find very interesting. I pretty well learnt it at Saga. And I think the key to it is you've got to try and make it sound live, although it isn't. You're stymied, of course, when something happens and you can't react to it. It is limited, of course. But it saves companies a lot of money by you don't have to go in every day. And I wouldn't want to go in 7 days a week anyway, obviously. But I think the key to it is to make, how do you make it sound live? I think by leaving in the odd little fluff here and there, because nobody speaks perfectly all the time. And sometimes I will say things like, Oh, good morning. Oh, it's afternoon now, isn't it? We're now into Wednesday afternoon. So there are little things that you can do. And sometimes I try and get somebody else who's there in the studio to come in and do a little chat with me. So there are ways, I think the key to it, most of all, is sounding bright. And I think however you feel, it's morning, it's bright. And it's going to be bright for the 5 hours that you're talking. And then you can go home and die. Well, not literally, hopefully, but as I always say, you know, it's better than working for a living. But I'm a radio enthusiast. I'm a radio buff. I love listening to radio. One of the stations I listen to a lot now is LBC. And I listen to Nick Ferrari, who I think is absolutely brilliant on. Brilliant, brilliant breakfast show. And of course, he's got all the contacts and everything. And he's a journalist. And so I have respect for people who I hear who I think are good broadcasters. But yeah, I mean, I do quite a lot of work now for BBC Sussex and Surrey, which is my local station. Every Boxing Day I go in, I do, there's a man who loves his work going on Boxing Day. It's obviously Deputy Dog, isn't it? Deputy Day, Boxing Day, but I don't mind. I go down to Brighton. I'm living in Sussex, so it's not too far away. I drive down, there's nothing around. I do 9 till 12, and I try and think of a different theme for every Boxing Day, you know. So, yeah, I love it. And I don't want to be in a studio every day of the week. I mean, I did that for, I'm trying to think how many years, probably about 40 years, which is a long time. I like a surprise. I like it when somebody says to me, well, would you like to come and do so-and-so, you know? I've got to a point now where I don't ask for anything. It's too demoralising to have anybody say no, you know. But that's one of the reasons. But also, it's a lovely surprise. I get an email, somebody says, Mark Carter at BBC Sussex in Surrey comes and says, do you fancy doing Boxing Day? Or do you fancy doing Sunday? They say, yeah, why not? Lovely. So, yeah. Well, I did a show at the London Palladium with a band called The Fugitives. A couple of girl singers and a guy singer, and they were very, very good. I did a show there with them twice. And they said to me, why don't we do it? We all get on very well together. Why don't we do a tour together? So I thought, well, we'll probably do about half a dozen venues. And it grew and grew until it became 40 theatres around the country. And it's called Rock and Roll Back the Years. And it's really, you know, when you get tribute shows, this is really a tribute to all the music we've loved. So it's Cliff, it's Elvis, it's the Everlys, it's the Big O. And things have evolved as we've gone through the tour very early on. Ed Stewart died. And I said to the girls, could you do Morning Town Ride, which was the old theme from Junior Choice, and could the band play it? Within a couple of days, they learned it, and I introduced it, and I stood in the wings with a lump in my throat, and as I heard them singing it, it reminded me of all the great times that I'd had with Ed, playing football together and being at Radio 1 and Radio 2 together, playing football charity matches. And I saw a lot of Ed in recent times. We had a lot of laughs together. And we've kept it in the show because it goes down so well.
All bound for Morning Town,
many miles away.
Sorry, couldn't help doing that. Such a great song, this Morning Town Ride by the Seekers. And that lovely voice of Judith Durham. And it's me, Stu Potts.
I think the young me would think that I should have done more. I think the young me would think I didn't do enough. I should have been more successful. Should have done more. I think most of all, I would like to think I made people laugh, and I think as well as my work, I think socially, I've always enjoyed a good laugh. I like other people with a sense of humour. I live on a farm now, and I've got some farming neighbours, and they said to me one day, something we've noticed, there's always lots of laughter coming from your garden. So I said, yeah, we like to laugh.